From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The Motion Picture Academy's come up with three ideas for addressing viewer flight from the Oscars. Move up the date, eliminate some categories from the show, and create another award. The new Popular Film Award arrived with a thud. It's getting hammered even though it isn't fully baked. The Oscars hopes from the Academy right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We bookend the show today with the movie business, because coming up at the end of our second hour, Leonard Maltin with us in studio to talk about his new book. A little bit later this hour, rent control. The petitions have fizzled in several Southern California cities. Is it a sign that the state rent control, Proposition 10, might face an uphill battle in November? But first, in a tweet, the Motion Picture Academy announced three changes designed to stop the flight of viewers away from the Oscar telecast. Last year saw the lowest ratings ever. The longer-term downward trend is even more concerning. One of the changes is to move the Oscars 2 weeks earlier, starting in 2020. That's to address award show fatigue. The show will supposedly be limited to 3 hours as well. Some of the categories will be awarded during commercials. Good luck hitting those timeposts. That's going to be fascinating. The most controversial is an apparently half-baked idea for a Popular Film Award. This presumably for a movie that made a lot of money, but wasn't as artistically strong as the Best Picture nominees. At least that's the closest I can figure it, but with us a man far more expert, John Horn, host of The Frame.
I don't think I can figure it out.
So, well, I mean, we've all been paying close attention to the Academy saying, you know, people concerned that more popular films don't get Oscar nominations as the arty ones do. But
well, A, not true. B, there already is an award for most popular film. It's called the People's Choice Awards. The Academy Awards are about excellence in film, and sometimes those films are popular, maybe not necessarily the films that win Best Picture. This year's ceremony, Get Out, huge hit, won an Oscar. Dunkirk, huge hit, won three Oscars. Both films were up for Best Picture. Their directors, Jordan Peele and Christopher Nolan, were up for Best Director. So yes, the Academy doesn't always honor the highest grossing film of the year, but there's a reason why, and that's because the highest grossing film of the year isn't necessarily any good. So that's one problem. The one problem is that you are not honoring box office success, you are honoring excellence. And then when you create a new category, what does that mean to films that fall into that category? It's like Miss Congeniality at Miss America. You're not very pretty, but, you know, people like you.
Say you're Jordan Peele or Chris Nolan, and your film this category was there last year. And one of those two films, both, I think, excellent movies, they win. Isn't that like saying, hey, yeah, you know, but it wasn't as artistically good as, you know, as Shape of Water?
I can't imagine any filmmaker outside of maybe Michael Bay in a Transformers film actually being excited about the creation of this category, because it does feel that it's a second-class award. And I think more important, it does create a problem. And in 2001, the Academy added a new Oscar for animated feature. You could debate it about whether or not it was a good idea or not. But one consequence is that in some years, and I think by any objective standards, one of the greatest films of the year, I'm thinking Inside Out from three
Absolutely.
Years ago, not nominated for Best Picture because it's put into this other category, Best Animated. So it has ghettoized animated features even when they're the best films of the year.
I'd argue Coco was a deserved Best Picture nominee. But again, it wins for Best Animated Feature, deservedly so, but ends up ghettoized into its own category. I'd like to hear from you as an Air Talk listener, particularly if you're an Academy member. What do you think about this? Even looking at unnamed public relations professionals quoted in stories on this, scratching their head like, what are they doing here? 866-893-KPCC. And there are kind of two issues, John. The one is, is a sort of participation, you know, trophy. Is this a good idea to award popularity? The other is the way in which they did it, with it not being fully put together. Is this a trial balloon? Or?
Well, if it's a trial balloon, it is going to pop very quickly. But also, there is no definition of what is popular. Is it box office success? Is that what you're measuring it by? Because if it's box office success, that means Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom would be in this category. Not a lot of critical love for that film, or Solo, Star Wars Story, the new latest Lucasfilm film that got devastated by critics, did well enough at the box office. So, like, what is popular? I mean, you could argue that the documentary Won't You Be My Neighbor, beloved by audiences, loved by critics, the documentary RBG, same. That's a popular film. It's a documentary. It doesn't compete on the box office scale of some of these blockbusters, but so why not put documentaries in this category? I don't even know how you begin to define it.
866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. What do you think of the popular film category that the Motion Picture Academy is creating for the Oscars? I also wonder about this idea of taking some of the categories. I don't know which ones they'll be. And, you know, let's say, for example, it's costume design, and they put that during the commercial. John, first of all, technically, you better have a host during that who knows how to hit a time post.
Well,
exactly.
Yes. Well, in those categories that are not going to be on the broadcast, like, say, the Sound Effects Editing Award, those guys are probably burning the Academy down right now. I mean, they're going to be really unhappy because they are integral to the filmmaking process. There's been an argument that short films, live action animated short films, should be cut from the ceremony because nobody sees those as movies. Nobody sees those in theaters. But when you get to the technical aspects of any film, costumes, makeup, editing, those are critical awards. And sometimes some of the most heartfelt speeches come out of those categories. So what, how you decide what is and is not in, how you cut down the ceremony to 3 hours. I have the privilege of going to the Oscars every year. I love the show. I don't think it's too long. I mean, you're waiting all year for the Academy Awards.
but it's your business.
Yeah, but you don't worry about, as a friend of mine said, you don't worry about the Super Bowl being 15 minutes too long. It's like, it's the Super Bowl. It's the Oscars.
All right. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Let's talk with Jeff in Hollywood. Jeff, what do you think of this idea?
Well, I'm not a big fan of the popular movie category. I think it's foolishness. But I would really be in favor of doing categories like best comedy, since comedies often get ignored. And also, even best action film. Why not? Hollywood does great versions of these things, and they don't get treated as such during the Oscars. I think it would make those fun.
So make them a little more like the Golden Globes.
Yeah, maybe much more legitimate than the Golden Globes. I was actually talking to an Academy member yesterday, and he said he had pitched that same idea to the Academy, create categories like drama, comedy, and then the top vote getters from that, from those awards get into the Best Picture race. So it solves part of the problem. It gets some populist films in there. They're not segregated into this nether category. And then the top nominees in that those respective groups end up in the Best Picture race. I thought it was a creative and interesting solution. The Academy had no interest in it.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to make a lot more sense. Jeff, thank you for your call. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Norman Lakewood sort of taking issue with me calling it half-baked. The Academy's essentially said it's half-baked. They're not saying this is the done deal or that they figured it out, which, John, is strange to me. Why would you sort of throw this out? Well, we're going to have some sort of an award for a popular movie. We don't know what it is or what the criteria is. Just throw it out that way.
Well, I have three recent examples. New Coke, Windows Vista, Google Glass. I mean, these are smart companies, Microsoft, Coke, and Google. They have new products that they think, you know, the world is ready for. The world is not only not ready for them, but also completely uninterested in them. So listen, they have a ratings problem. The ratings for the show have been declining. As you said, this year's ceremony was the lowest rated in modern history. The solution to that may not be, you know, adding this new category. And even if the ratings are down, they're still huge. So I don't know that you are really solving the problem. And as the Academy is trying to address some of its, you know, fundamental problems in terms of membership and diversity, it has invited a lot of younger filmmakers and actors in, and they might start recognizing some of these more popular films. They could also start recognizing even indier films, artier films. So the Academy is trying to change its membership, and how that change affects the nominees, we don't know, because it's just now happening. And there's so many older, whiter male members that as this new group comes in, the changes for the new members are going to take a couple of years to reveal themselves.
Mark in Santa Ana, you're on Air Talk. What do you think?
Well, I think John Horne is absolutely 100% right.
As he always is.
Well,
don't tell my wife that.
As a voting member of the Academy, I think it is outrageous and completely disrespectful to the many important categories that make up great cinema. And I think this is a boneheaded move that is going in absolutely the wrong direction. We need to celebrate, as John said so correctly, excellence in cinema and excellence in the crafts and categories that make motion picture not only a popular art form, but a real art form in and itself. And I think this is completely the wrong direction to go in. The answer is diversity, as John indicated. The answer is another generation, a newer generation of younger, innovative filmmakers that are participating and supporting the excellence of the Academy, not cultivating or going to the lowest common denominator by trying to create an art
form.
Category as in popular film.
Mark, I appreciate it very much, John.
Yeah, and I would say even though it's rare, the Academy has awarded the Best Picture Oscar to some huge blockbusters. Titanic would be a great example. The last Lord of the Rings movie took the Best Picture. It's not like the Academy is hostile to popular films. It's just, as I said earlier, popular films aren't necessarily excellent as judged by the Academy.
Gleno, writing on the Air Talk page, echoing, you said, what would this have done to Best Picture winners that were also wildly popular? Examples, The Return of the King, Slumdog Millionaire, Titanic, Braveheart, Silence of the Lambs, Dances with Wolves, etc.
Yeah, Argo. I mean, you know, you can make an argument. Argo is a very popular film.
Yeah.
A lot of people liked it, well-reviewed. What happens to those films, and this is the really important question, what happens to Black Panther? Does this mean Black Panther doesn't get in the Best Picture race, which it should, or does it become, you know, one of these lesser films and end up in this new category?
Well, it could end up in both.
It could. I mean, we don't know. We don't know if there's going to be separate, if there's going to be any overlap. I suspect there won't be.
Jim in Claremont writes on the page, in the early years, they had a category for unique and artistic achievement separate from the Best Picture category on the assumption the latter would be popular movies and art, like Sunrise, which won in 1929, given a special category. This is just a detour that'll last a couple of years or so. Jim, from what John is saying, he's not sure it'll last 1 year. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, KPECC.org. Connie in Irvine, welcome.
Thank you. I am an avid film goer, and I think I'm agreeing with your previous caller. It's a ridiculous idea. I think we have to consider the intent of the Academy Awards and the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and the intent is to award excellence in film and all that goes along with that in all of the categories. By adding a popular film category, it will completely dilute and diminish the intent of what the Academy is supposed to be. And I also disagree with moving some of the categories into commercial breaks. I love the costume category. And those that are interesting to most of us that love film, we're not going to want to miss it and instead watch a commercial. As for the short films, I think they're becoming more popular. I know that in many, many cities, you can go at least watch all of the Academy Award-nominated short films and animated films. And so I think that's maybe becoming something that in the future may be more well-known. And I would hate to see those categories go by the wayside as well.
Connie, appreciate the call. Thank you so much. John, we're just about out of time. Where do you think this is headed?
I mean, the reaction on social media and in news articles from film critics, from Academy members, has been universally negative. I mean, I think if the Academy was floating a trial balloon, the early votes are in. The absentees may not be, but the early opinion is really negative. I can't really see a way forward for the Academy unless it feels it has to do this to save the ratings. I don't even know it's going to change the ratings. It feels like it has really been poorly received.
All right. John Horn, host of The Frame, weekday afternoons here on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll take a look at local rent control initiatives that have fizzled out in cities throughout Southern California. What's behind that? And does that provide a showing of an early challenge for the rent control measure on the California ballot coming up in November? It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk today. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up a little bit later, we're going to talk about proposed changes for college basketball that would allow players coming out of high school to once again go directly to the NBA. But if they didn't get drafted, they could still come back, go to college. We'll talk about that. But first, we turn our attention to rent control, where in several Southern California cities, activists have failed to get enough signatures to qualify for the upcoming ballot. They have an October 15th deadline to make it onto the 2020 ballot. Santa Ana, they're still gathering signatures. But in Glendale, Long Beach, Pasadena, Inglewood, and Pomona, the drives have all struggled. Question is, what are the factors behind that? And secondly, does that potentially pose concern for supporters of the ballot measure, which would change the rent control guidelines statewide? That's coming up in November. Joining us to talk about the issue is a former assembly member from the Glendale area, now real estate attorney, Mike Gatto, who joins us, and also Mike Van Gorder, founding member of the Glendale Tenants Unit, a union which was sponsoring the Glendale Rent Control Initiative. Let me start with you, Mr. Van Gorder. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having us.
So what happened in Glendale? Why were you not able to get enough signatures?
Okay. Well, first, we have to put this into context. In Glendale, the city of Glendale, there's a 90-year-old woman that just got a $1,400 rent hike. This is what we're up against. This is what we're fighting. This is why we are doing.
We spend a lot of time talking about the rent crisis. But specifically, given the kinds of stories you're detailing, why was it so difficult to get the minimum number of signatures?
Well, we're about to have a conversation about basketball. Let me ask you this. Do you think Michael Jordan dunked on his first attempt? Like, framing this conversation in terms of, well, they failed, it's fizzled, you know, and that's that. It really does a disservice. We see this issue as more of an indictment of the voter-led initiative process, because Glendale, Inglewood, Pasadena, like, these are we didn't all start with armies. We started with about a few dozen people apiece, you know. We saw this as a crucial need that we had to work on right now. So we started these attempts without any resources. And then over the course of the campaign, those resources bloomed. We have an army now. We have funding now. We have thousands of people who have signed on, in addition to the thousands of people that signed on to this campaign that we had last year. These things take time. They take multiple attempts. Saying that, like, well, it fizzled, it's really selling us short. We are prepared for the long haul. As long as we can fight, we will, until we lose our homes, that is.
All right. So in Glendale, you needed to get over 10,500 signatures. You got, what, about 4,000 signatures in Glendale?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess my point is,
given how hard rent is, affecting so many people, and people who've had to move out of so many communities because they can't afford the rent, why do you think it's been so difficult to get that army of volunteers to go out to get the signatures? Glendale has a lot of people, but it's not huge in square mileage. This would seem a case where it was doable.
Yeah, I mean, there's 200,000 people that live in Glendale. Two-thirds of those are renters, so we've got about 120,000 people that would be our outreach. But outreach costs money. It costs resources. It costs time. We're dealing with people who have neither time nor money, and we're trying to say, come on, get on board with this. We crunched the numbers, and if we paid people for their time, we would need to spend about $60,000 worth of time and money just to put this thing to the voters. We think that's absurd, but we're going to try anyway. We have to try anyway because our city council is being intransigent on this issue. We're not seeing any leadership from our city government, so we're trying to lead. And we know this is going to be a multi-campaign issue. And over time, we'll build up those resources. But it's not it presumes an equal playing field of just dropping us into the middle of the situation saying, all right, catch up. You have, $24 in your group account. You have to somehow reach thousands of people. These things grow. These things absolutely grow. We've grown more in the past month and a half as the tenants union than we had in the first 4 months of this campaign.
And do you think the issue's been the same in all the other cities?
Absolutely. Yes. It's not fair if you can, we don't have the same culture of civic participation that we used to. There is no one central market that everybody in town goes to. There's no town criers. There are gates in front of people's apartment buildings anymore. People do most of their interpersonal connection online. These are all huge challenges. The California state legislature won't accept any participation in a legal sense with a petition that exists online in any way. It has to be in person. And that means we have to, with an average signature return rate of 8 signatures an hour, we have to go out into the world over 6 months and get people to sign this thing. Whereas if someone is running for election, everybody knows that there's an election day. You go to a specific place and people can get these votes just by virtue of being on a ballot. We don't have that. We have to go to people. We have to convince people where they are, sometimes in their homes, sometimes at their shop, where they shop. Sometimes where they work.
Mike,
that is a huge expense of time and effort.
Mike Van Gorder is the founding member of the Glendale Tenants Union, also with us. Mike Gatto, real estate attorney, former California State Assembly member who represented Glendale. So, Mr. Gatto, what do you think is at work with these local rent control initiatives and the challenge they've had qualifying them?
Well, I think these initiatives have failed in so many cities across Southern California. Because in the cities that you mentioned, Larry, these voters are engaged, they're educated, and they have a tremendous experience voting, and they know that these ballot initiatives always have unintended consequences. They know that these ballot initiatives are flawed. They've got experience with ballot initiatives over time that did things that they didn't promise to do and had a really, really horrific effect on the economy or on the world that we live in. Voters in these communities, voters in Glendale, are pro-science. We know that we like to make informed decisions based on studies and based on reports. In almost every study, including ones from very progressive authors, there's a landmark study from Stanford University last year from two very progressive authors concluded that rent control doesn't work. What it results in is, ironically, is higher rents. People are more likely to, people are more likely not to build more housing. Folks cling on to places where there's reduced mobility, which drives down the supply of any units available on the market at any given time. These initiatives just don't work.
Well, one thing, just to clarify that Stanford report, as I understand it, it didn't say in total it didn't work, because as I recall, the results said for individuals who are in rent control units, it works great for them and enables many people to stay in units they wouldn't otherwise have been able to stay in. But the unintended consequence of that is that it depressed the creation of new housing stock and that it disadvantaged other renters who didn't have rent control. That was my understanding.
It basically said that a tiny, tiny minority who's lucky enough to get one of these places might have lower rent, But everybody else, you know, 95% of the rest of California suffered. The biggest issue right now is housing. When you talk to everybody, people on the left, economists on the right, everybody's in agreement that California needs more housing. We're not building enough housing. And these initiatives completely stifle the construction of new housing. And I think that would be obviously the biggest factor. Creating more housing would be the biggest factor in keeping housing costs affordable.
Oh, we're talking with Mike Gatto, also with us Mike Van Gorder, and the professor and director of the Center for the Study of Los Angeles at Loyola Marymount University, Fernando Guerra, who's also a member of our Southern California Public Radio Board of Trustees. Fernando, good morning. Do you think that these local rent control campaigns that have not garnered sufficient support, is that at all a bellwether for Prop 10, the statewide rent control measure?
Somewhat, but not completely. It's a very different process in terms of trying to gather signatures. As Mr. Van Gorder said, is a very difficult process. The election in November regarding Prop 10 basically gets rid of a moratorium of cities putting rent control. It doesn't force rent control. It allows the cities to do it. And the basic argument there is that, look, we have a one solution fits all, and many cities are so different that we should have this at the local level. And it was at the local level for many years until the legislature intervened. So if Prop 10 passes, which I think right now, if the election were today, it would pass. There's obviously going to be a lot of information and commercials from those against Proposition 10, which may sway the vote. But I think that Proposition 10 will pass. That doesn't mean that you're all of a sudden going to get rent control everywhere. It means that certain cities can then go ahead and do it. And while
by the way, I disagree with that.
Hold on just a moment. Go ahead, Fernando.
Yeah. And what then happens is that cities have ability at the local level to have even citywide or even neighborhood-wide rent control. So I could imagine that the city of L.A. Creates a legislation that would say in certain types of neighborhoods, like, for instance, Pico Union, we're going to have rent control. Why Pico Union? There is no new construction going on, and there's not likely to be new construction going on. And so the argument that rent control there would prevent new construction doesn't work. And so that you can then give all kinds of policy alternatives to local cities to deal with this. Now, there is a theory that rent control impacts the building of housing, but we haven't had rent control in the last 20 some odd years, and housing has gotten worse. So to the idea to blame rent control on the lack of housing just isn't true in the last 20 years is the great example of that.
All right. Fernando Guerra of Loyola Marymount University. Mike Van Gorder of the Glendale Tennis Union, you wanted to say something there?
That was me, but I'm happy to jump in.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
The economists that the landlord lobby and former Assemblymember Gatto like to cite here, they're talking about rent freezes for the most part. And also, you have to understand that the rent control efforts in California right now have been hamstrung by this overreaching state law, Costa-Hawkins, that we're trying to turn back with Prop 10. You know, cities do need to decide what's best for their own markets. And housing building is higher in cities with rent control because they're not directly related to one another in the sense that one causes the other. It's an indication that there's a really hot market somewhere, and we need to protect the long-term residents who have been there. In addition to creating more new housing.
Mike Gatto, go ahead. Yeah, hang on. Mike Gatto, go ahead.
Study after study has shown that the exact opposite of what he's saying happens. You're talking increasing prices on existing housing, making it more difficult for families to purchase their first home. You're talking forcing thousands of renters, including seniors, out of their apartments because people tend to convert rental properties into more profitable uses when they can't rent them out. This is a flawed initiative, and I think when voters, it's very easy for people to poo-poo the intelligence of the California voter, but I think when voters get the information on this, when they find out that it's going to create 539 rental boards in different communities that set the price for renting an extra home, I think they will start to say that this initiative is ridiculous. Look, we all have experience with ballot initiatives with unintended consequences. all of us remember Three Strikes and all the debates before it, but then it sent people to jail for things like stealing a slice of pizza. We all remember Prop 47, which
all right.
thousands of mentally ill people on the street without treatment. This initiative will have, it's deeply flawed. It'll have unintended consequences.
All right. I need to break. Thank you, Mike Gatto. Thank you, Mike Van Gorder and Fernando Guerra. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. The NCAA has announced a series of policy and rules changes around college basketball. The NCAA has been dealing with a wide-ranging FBI investigation into allegations of corruption in the sport over the past couple of years. Plus, there's the one-and-done problem, where some of the most talented players in the country go to a top-level college basketball program, stay for only a year just to make themselves eligible for the NBA draft, and then they're gone. We're going to talk about the proposals and get your thoughts on them as well. With us, a reporter for The Athletic. He covers the NBA draft, college basketball, and the NBA, Sam Vecenie. Sam, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Larry, how's it going?
I'm doing well, thanks. So describe for us, first of all, the effort here to deal with the one and done, where players out of high school can declare for the NBA draft. How would that work?
So the one and done is an NBA rule more so than a college rule, right? The NCAA stuff that happened yesterday, it doesn't really have a whole lot to do with the one and done. But the one and done in general is that you have to go to school. You cannot go directly from high school to the NBA. You have to go to college for a year. You have to spend a season outside of high school, be it in Australia, as one kid did 2 years ago, be it in Europe, as we've seen in the past, or be it in college basketball, which is the option that many kids take. You have to be out of high school for a year and have to be at least 19 years old to enter the NBA draft.
Okay, and so is this kind of a call in these rules changes for the NBA to allow 18-year-olds to be able to declare for the draft?
I don't know that they're necessarily calling for it. Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, has been very clear. This rule has been in effect since before he took over as commissioner. It's something that he feels very strongly about, that he wants to change. They're just figuring out the timing on their end in terms of how to do it so as to not affect competitive balance within the league. Right now, their projections are right around 2021 to 2022. In all likelihood, in terms of when that will go into effect. These rules are, the NCAA rules from yesterday, are more going into effect in order to try and curb the potential for harmful outside influences within the NCAA and within the development of youth basketball throughout the country. The one and done is a little bit tangential, although it is connected to a couple of the rules that they enacted yesterday.
So is part of this also to cut the influence of the shoe companies who put so much money into the sport with the idea of, you know, signing athletes to endorsement deals?
Yeah, that's exactly what the NCAA, I think, is trying to curb in many ways. They want the Nike, the Adidases, the Under Armours to be a little bit less involved than they are currently. They believe that the connection to these shoe companies have created a circumstance where it doesn't force coaches, but it incentivizes corruption among the ranks of coaches, among the ranks of agents, among the ranks of players and players' parents as well. So it's, it's a very convoluted situation in terms of how we develop basketball players in this country.
What effect would these rules changes have on the use of agents by players?
So one of the rules that went into effect yesterday was that at the end of each college basketball season, players are going to be able to hire agents in an above board manner in order to get advice from them and for the agents to be able to pay for their training, for expenses flying around to different team workouts, to meals, etc., like that. In my opinion, though, it's not really going to change a whole lot, because one of the misnomers I think that's out there is that you're allowed as a player to get advice from agents. You just can't take benefits from agents. Like, speaking to an agent is not illegal insofar as getting advice from him, kind of figuring out where your draft stock is, for instance, figuring out what team is going to take you. What is illegal is getting a benefit from that agent, getting a car, getting even a dinner is not legal. So what these rule changes do is it just makes it more above board, I guess, for them to pay for expenses. But honestly, I don't really think the effect is going to be all that much.
And for underclassmen who want to declare for the draft, but aren't sure they're going to get drafted or don't get drafted, how do the new rules affect them?
So 2 years ago, the NCAA input a rule that allowed kids to declare for the draft in order to, quote unquote, test their stock. And one of the byproducts of that has been that we've seen an influx of kids declare for the draft and just kind of see what ends up happening in terms of, you know, are NBA teams interested in bringing them in for workouts? Are they potentially able to get drafted? Are they able to get a two-way contract? Are they able to get any sort of deal in terms of training camp, etc.? What these rules yesterday input is that if you get invited to the NBA draft combine and you are not drafted in the NBA draft, you are now able to return to school and continue on with your college career. And it's a fine change. I mean, it helps a few kids, but it's very limited in scope because there are only about 70 kids to 65 kids, something in that range, who are invited to the NBA draft combine every year. And there are 60 NBA draft slots, right? So say that 7 of those go to European kids, you're really not affecting much in terms of who this rule is going to help, because you limited it to the NBA draft combine invites.
We're talking with The Athletic's Sam Vecenie, reporter who covers the NBA, college basketball, and the NBA draft, talking about the changes that the NCAA has put into place for college basketball. This coming out of that blue ribbon panel that Condoleezza Rice chaired to look at reforms in college sports. Rick Burton is professor of sports management and faculty athletic representative to the Atlantic Coast Conference and the NCAA at Syracuse University. Professor Burton, thank you for being with us.
Larry, good to be with you.
How important do you think these changes are?
Well, I think they're good on a number of levels, in so much as from an optics standpoint, the NCAA had made a commitment to address the problem that brought the FBI into play. And Mark Emmert, the president of the NCAA, had committed to change and fast change, or, you know, rapid change. So I think you're seeing the first step here, and I think that works at least at the optic level. I think secondarily it probably sends a message to the coaches and the players and the agents and the people that are running the AAU teams that the NCAA is stepping up its commitment to this entire process.
One of the other reforms starting in August of next year, Division I schools will be required to pay for tuition, books, fees for scholarship basketball players who leave school and return within 10 years to the same school to earn their first degree. Like a decade-long active scholarship. Interesting reform.
Yeah, I think that we have to always try to remember, and it's great having Sam on the phone because I thought he hit it, you know, really right on the head, but these are student athletes first, and not everyone believes that, and not everyone goes to college necessarily to get educated. But the intent of the NCAA and the member institutions is to provide an education and to give these student athletes the greatest opportunity for success later in their lives. Athletic careers generally don't go much beyond, you know, 5 years. And in a lot of cases, what you don't want to have is someone that then is maybe broke, you know, maybe has spent all the money that they might have made from the NBA in the first few years, and now they're not really prepared for the next 50 or 60 years of their life.
This doesn't, though, really address the larger issue of players who, while they're playing for the school on scholarship. In many cases don't have money to eat well, to do much of anything beyond, you know, just go to class, go to practice. And that issue is left unaddressed here, isn't it?
Well, not really. The NCAA addressed the food issue a number of years ago when Shabazz Napier so famously came on the air after one of the NCAA tournament games and said, "I go to bed hungry at night sometimes." The food provisions and the kind of benefits that are provided to NCAA student athletes is really pretty amazing. But I think the soundbite that's out there is that these athletes are not getting anything, and I just don't think that that's accurate in any way.
We'll continue our conversation with Rick Burton, professor at Syracuse University, Sam Vecini of the Athletic online sports publication. We'll take your calls as well. If you're someone from the world of college basketball or a closely following fan of the sport, be interested in your thoughts. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Back in 1 minute. We're focused on the NCAA's announcement yesterday of reforms in college basketball. This in the wake of a lengthy FBI investigation into alleged corruption in the sport. We're talking with Syracuse University professor Rick Burton. He's professor of sports management. He's also the school's faculty representative to the Atlantic Coast Conference and the NCAA. And Sam Vecini writes on the NBA, the NBA draft, college basketball for the online sports publication, The Athletic. He also hosts a basketball podcast called Game Theory. Our phone lines are open for you at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Tony writes on the page, the NCAA views men's basketball as a cash cow. They need those talented freshmen. And the NBA doesn't want to pay for a minor league system, so they won't draft kids straight out of high school. See how this works, Tony says. Sam Vecini, your response to Tony's point.
I think that used to be true, for sure, under David Stern's tenure when he was the commissioner of the NBA. I believe that that was definitely the thought process. But since Adam Silver has taken over as the head of the NBA and as he's started to work more closely with the owners, I think that that mindset has changed. And I think it's going to change within the next 4 years. And they are going to start taking 18-year-olds into the NBA again.
Well, does having the what's now called the G League, the minor league, does that make a difference here? Because, in fact, some of these 18-year-olds you could put on those teams and they would be a draw in and of themselves in some of these markets.
Not quite yet. We're getting there, but the infrastructure for the league isn't quite there yet. Like, these kids only make around $35,000. Like, there's a kid, Darius Bazley, who Rick will know well because he was committed to Syracuse originally, actually. He decided to forego his commitment to Syracuse and decide to play in the G League next year. He'll only make like $35,000 this year in the G League. And to be honest, the amount of value that he would have received from Syracuse in terms of training, in terms of food, you know, housing, etc., it exceeds the $35,000. Yeah.
All right. Sam, has there been any student reaction in the less than a day since this came out? Have you talked with any student athletes?
I haven't talked to any student athletes. I've been talking more to coaches and the leagues involved and agents, et cetera. There's certainly been a reaction to there, you know, in terms of who, you know, what these rule changes will affect. But, you know, I haven't talked to any student athletes. I would imagine that it doesn't make a huge difference to them, to be honest.
What do coaches think there's much difference here?
Coaches certainly think that it's going to create a change. There have been changes to the recruiting calendar. Instead of going to AAU circuit events throughout the month of June, you're now, or throughout the month of July, or originally, you now have to do two high school events throughout the month of June, and you only get one AAU event in the month of July. Coaches aren't real excited about that because they don't think these events in June involving high school camps are going to be all that good. There's also a third or a second one in July involving regional camps that are supposed to be run by USA Basketball, that USA Basketball, from what I understand, is not super excited about having to run because they're not sure they have the infrastructure to necessarily do it. Yeah, like there's the level of play at these camps is not going to be as strong as what the AAU circuit is. So these coaches are a little bit worried about getting proper evaluations of players.
Sam, you know, we hear a lot about the AAU circuits, the shoe companies paying attention to kids long before, you know, they're coming to college. Is this going to have any effect on the younger kids who already are, you know, in high school identified as the prime talent?
I don't think it will, because to be honest, the incentive for agents in shoe companies to get involved with these kids, it's too great, to be honest. Like there's too much there. As long as the model of amateurism continues, and as long as kids are not allowed to make money off of their likenesses, it really creates just a black market of potential value that these kids aren't realizing. So I think the incentive is still there for them to try and cheat. The incentive is still there for parents to accept money whenever agents try and cheat. So I don't really think anything there has really been addressed, even if enforcement on behalf of the NCAA side has been improved within these changes.
If the players, you know, the most talented players for whom there would be deals available, money available, if they were allowed to profit from their likeness while still in college, how do you think that would change things?
I think that it would put everything in a more above board manner. I think that it would certainly help things. It would allow kids to get what they're worth. You know, Rick brought up the fact that the narrative about this is that kids don't get anything. And I agree with that. I think that that is a poor narrative that is espoused by many. But the fact of the matter is that in many cases, these kids don't necessarily get what they're worth in terms of value. Like there are kids in the ACC that are worth millions of dollars and should be able to get access to that money, in my opinion. So I think that it would certainly help in terms of allowing kids to make the money that they are actually worth.
Rick Burton, professor, Syracuse University. How do you think the sport would change if players were able to do endorsement deals or profit from their likeness?
Well, I think it becomes a little bit of Animal Farm that, you know, everyone is created equal, but some are more equal than others. And I think, you know, if you put this into a football discussion, are you going to reward quarterbacks and wide receivers, but not so much offensive linemen? If you put it into, you know, a basketball thing, are you going to reward the scorer, but not the point guard? I think it becomes problematic because we have this sense that we owe more, and Sam spoke about it. It's kind of a discussion of not, you know, whether or not they're being paid in the sense of a scholarship or meals or housing or any of the other things that a college student athlete gets, but that they could potentially be getting more. Now, it's only a handful of people who maybe could be getting more, and at whose expense? You know, are you going to disrupt team chemistry because this player is going to be able to have his likeness plastered in a national ad or regional ad or local?
Pros deal with that all the time, though, that you have maybe one player on the team gets an endorsement deal and no one else gets anything of consequence. You think college students couldn't handle that?
Well, you're talking, I assume, at the professional level,
yeah,
not at the college level, because student athletes at the college level are not getting endorsement deals.
No, but I'm saying if they did, if, because I thought you were saying it would damage team chemistry if one kid gets a deal and no one else does. And I was saying, well, pros handle that sort of, you know, lack of equity when it comes to it. So I was wondering why it would be harder for the college students. Anyway, it's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We have much more to come in our second hour of Air Talk.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, helping businesses improve their bottom line with solar water heating. The system preheats your water using the strength of the sun. It works with your existing natural gas water heater to warm your water in a reliable and efficient way. You may save on your SoCal Gas bill and get rebates that may cover up to 80% of the system's cost. With these rebates, heating water with the sun could be a sound investment. It's the strength of the sun in your business. Learn more at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Coming up later this hour, Leonard Maltin, the film veteran, sharing with us his insights over decades working in film. It goes back to his teenage years. He was a publisher, writer, had a whole subscriber base. I think he had 400 subscribers to his publication when he was 15 years old. So he's been at this a while. Leonard Maltin will be joining us later this hour on Air Talk. But first, whenever I talk with friends or family members in the beach communities lately, the thing that comes up first above everything else is, what about the electric scooters? What's going on with the scooters? What regulations are coming? This seems to have become daily conversation in communities like Santa Monica, Venice, Marina del Rey, the South Bay, areas that have seen the electric scooters take over the city streets. But in what ways is Los Angeles trying to figure out how to regulate the scooters? Very pleased to have with us Megan McCarty-Carino, KPCC reporter who covers commuting and mobility, and she listened in on yesterday's LA City Council Transportation Committee meeting.
Hey,
good morning,
Larry.
Megan.
Good
Hi.
Morning.
So what are they grappling with here?
So, you know, these are a set of regulations that the LA City Council has been crafting for some time. They were actually originally introduced when dockless bikes were a new thing that were kind of hitting LA City streets last October, and have kind of evolved to cover scooters, which of course have become the predominant mode that people think of when we think about these dockless devices.
Overnight, it
seems. Overnight, just amazingly exploded and became this phenomenon. So, you know, the Transportation Committee had approved these regulations having to do with capping the size of the fleets, you know, certain things about sharing information on the data that these companies collected with the city, these kinds of things. And yesterday they went back to the drawing board wanting to add some more regulations. What they did yesterday was they added, you know, a stipulation that these regulations would apply to any future as of yet unknown devices that, like the scooters, might catch cities unaware. So any kind of shared mobility devices that might hit the scene, you know, Councilman Bonin mentioned the hoverboards, if there's shared hoverboard app or something like that, anything that, you know, might pop up overnight, that these regulations would also apply to those devices so they wouldn't have to start from scratch from everything. And also a cap on the speed of the devices. This was very interesting because currently all of the scooters right now that are on the streets are capped, you know, in their devices at around 15 miles per hour. The new regulation that was added to these regulations by Transportation Committee would cap the speed at 12 miles per hour for all devices. Now, obviously, it's not like, oh, a difference between 15 miles per hour and 12 miles per hour is going to make a huge difference. But what the council said when they added this was that, you know, Councilman Bonin, who chairs the Transportation Committee, had heard or, you know, was intuiting that it may become an issue that as more and more companies kind of join this burgeoning marketplace of wanting to add scooters and dockless devices to the streets, that one of the things that they might try to distinguish themselves from the rest of the pack is by making the devices faster. So even though right now we're at 15 miles per hour, you know, I've heard there are as many as 12, 13 companies that are getting in on this in Santa Monica that have applied for permits in Santa Monica. And, you know, they're all pricing structures are similar. So how are they going to distinguish themselves? Maybe by making each device a little bit faster than the other one. So LA City wanted to get in front of this and say no faster than 12 miles per hour.
Well, it's interesting, though, that the proposal is for slower than the current ones
right.
can go.
Yeah.
Have people been complaining about the speed of the... I've heard a lot of complaints. Speed isn't one that I've heard.
Yeah, speed doesn't seem to be at the top of the list in terms of the kind of, you know, disruptions that they're causing. I mean, I think certainly the speed influences the way that they are, you know, causing problems on sidewalks. But speed is not, I mean, they are not allowed on sidewalks, whether they go 12 miles per hour or 15 miles per hour. I think it also can affect, you know, when they're turning or going into intersections and things like that. You know, and cars don't see them coming. But again, I don't think 12 miles per hour is really going to change the calculus on that.
I'd love to hear from listeners. What do you think about this? Do you like the idea proposed by the City Transportation Committee? in Los Angeles to cap the speed of the electric scooters at 12 miles an hour. That's a bit slower than what they're able to go right now. Also, what do you think in the way of regulations just generally the city should introduce? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Now, currently, the scooter companies like Bird are most operating in the beach areas, right, where there are a lot of tourists, dense, a lot of, you know, walkers, people out on the street. Is the city looking at trying to encourage this in other parts of town?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the pretty interesting things about the regulations that the city of LA has been crafting, is that, you know, council members from districts that have been underserved by a lot of other mobility things like Metro Bike Share and things like that have really wanted to craft the regulations in such a way that they encourage these companies to introduce these devices in areas like, you know, the valley, you know, certain neighborhoods where people are reliant on walking and biking and taking transit. But are not kind of the target areas where these companies are setting up shop, like the beach areas. So what they've done with the regulations is, you know, I mentioned that they have a cap on the number of devices and they will charge a certain amount for devices, each device that the company places on the street. So what they've done is to incentivize companies to put these devices in more underserved areas is to actually say, you know, okay, you can have this many devices in Venice, but if you add, say, 1,000 devices in another area that is underserved, we'll increase your cap in this other area, and we won't charge you per device the same amount for these devices that are in the underserved area. So it's kind of an interesting method to try to get these companies to have equity in the way that they're distributing the devices.
Of course, the potential problem is if those expanded areas aren't as profitable for them,
yeah,
then are the companies really going to invest in the upkeep, in, right, making sure that, you know, the e-scooters are not, you know, blocking sidewalks? Are they going to be doing the follow-up,
right,
necessary, or are all the resources still going to go into the highly profitable touristy areas?
Yeah, and this is always, you know, a concern when we're thinking about private companies offering a service that we see as kind of a public service. You know, private companies have different motivations than do LA Metro with the LA Metro Bike Share program. These are services
which is
definitely having problems in a way that, we see competition potentially. We see the scooters taking off in a way that bike share has not taken off, definitely in certain areas. Obviously, Pasadena shutting down its bike share program with Metro. Downtown LA has been among the more successful, and in Venice, more successful, but still, I don't think we don't have numbers from a lot of these private companies, but at least from the looks of it, it appears that the scooter's much more popular.
They're sure a lot more visible.
Yeah.
And yesterday I was talking with Metro CEO Phil Washington, right, and he indicated Metro's going to consider getting into the e-scooter business. You know, since people have taken to them so much.
Yeah, yeah. They definitely seem to offer something not only in the pricing structure, but in the riding experience that is obviously more appealing to people. You know, it keeps you in an upright position that is more similar to walking, so you can look around. You know, they're not as heavy as the bikes. People are not using them in the way that they are intended. They should not be ridden on the sidewalks. You have to have a driver's license. You should not be riding them, on the sidewalks. You have to have a helmet. You're supposed to be using a bike lane if the street is faster than 25 miles per hour. So certainly some of the things are not being enforced that are making the scooters easier to ride for some people, young people using them that do not have a driver's license and things like that. But I think for sure they are offering a riding experience that bikes have not been offering, and people are willing to take a chance on them.
Megan McCarty-Carino, KPCC's reporter covering commuting and mobility. We're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. A listener posts on the AirTalk page, limiting the speed limit lowering the speed limit only solves one potential problem. Another problem is the placement of scooters in the public right-of-way, which is a public public safety issue, tripping hazards, access issues. Most cities wouldn't want the liability of allowing the scooters to be placed anywhere on the right-of-way. A good solution would be to allow a certain number of scooters to be parked in certain locations through a city, similar to public bike stations.
Sure, yeah.
And but Santa Monica is less convenient.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that makes this technology so appealing is that it is pick up anywhere, leave anywhere, and that is one of the benefits of it. Santa Monica, I know, with its pilot program, which should be launching pretty soon now, they've taken applications from a number to permit these companies. Part of what they are proposing is that, you know, they would create special zones kind of, you know, off the sidewalk where people would be designated pickup and drop-off zones. If you've ever had any experience with the bike share in Santa Monica, these are also dockless devices, and you get a certain premium for leaving it or picking it up anywhere, but you get kind of an incentive in the pricing structure for leaving it or picking it up, you know, in a designated zone that has been designated. This is a good place to leave it, and so that they would have kind of painted blocks on the sidewalk, on the, you know, on the side of the road or something like that, keeping it off of the public right-of-way and incentivizing people to put the devices there, leave them there. But again, yes, I mean, one of the great benefits of this technology and one of the things that has attracted people to it has been this ability to pick it up and leave it anywhere.
Let's talk with Mark in Santa Monica. Mark, good to have you with us. What do you think about efforts to regulate the e-scooters?
Hi, thanks for having me on. First of all, I have a second home in Santa Monica, and my wife and I on occasion use Bird, you know, as a convenience, and, you know, a lot of the tourists use it. It's really kind of a cool program. But if the city gets involved with regulating, like every other thing the city gets their hands on, it's just going to be a disaster, like our trash service, our commercial trash service, and on and on and on. That's probably a whole different show. What I see the problem is it really there needs to be an enforcement team ticketing people so that the laws are driven home and people understand that if you don't use these pieces of equipment correctly, you'll get a ticket. And that'll help alleviate, you know, kids riding these things on the sidewalk and going too fast and not following the normal traffic rules. That seems to be the big issue with them.
Yeah. Megan, is that being discussed to do beefed up enforcement of the rules of the road for the e-scooters?
This is really interesting because actually I would say most of the biggest complaints about these scooters are not things that need to be handled with regulation or things having to do with the California Vehicle Code that just need to be enforced. I know in many cases, you know, there hasn't been any kind of resources allocated with these programs to beef up enforcement of these issues of riding on the sidewalk. This is a violation of California state law, riding without a helmet, riding without a driver's license, you know, riding on streets that don't have a bike lane that are very quick. So these are things that could be covered under current state law, but it seems that most places, you know, haven't figured out the enforcement aspect of this, how much resources to allocate to it and how to do so. Obviously, there are always strains on enforcement resources, you know, for all city budgets and finding ways to enforce this effectively, I think, is still very much a work in progress. I've heard from people, you know, saying some cities are giving out, you know, pretty expensive citations having to do with this. Could we come up with a system where the penalty fits the crime? You know, these are generally not fatal kinds of crashes that are occurring with these devices. It's not, you know, that kind of a threat to society the way car infractions could be. So, you know, could we have a system of warnings and education, you know, required kind of driver training for scooters if you have an infraction? But those things have yet to be worked out.
Yeah, again, because this has come up out of the middle of nowhere so fast. Astrogoth says, you know, or cites a problem of young teens using their parents' credit card to ride, sometimes riding double on the e-scooter. Says it's pure crazy. I mean, that's the kind of thing where if it was enforced,
right,
and the parents, you know, had some sort of financial penalty for allowing the kid to use the card that way. might make a difference. Mark, I appreciate your call. Thank you so much for being with us. Megan, as always, it's a pleasure. Thank you for lending us your expertise for the segment today.
Thank you.
Thanks. Megan McCarty-Carino joining us, KPCC commuting and mobility reporter. And as you would expect, she was listening in for that Transportation Committee meeting yesterday, LA City Hall. Coming up, one of those proposals, it's just been out there as a weird thing for years. What if we towed an iceberg down to Southern California and we used that to deal with our drought? Well, someone is actually preparing to do a real iceberg towing experiment. Yeah, crazy as that sounds, we'll talk about it when we continue on Air Talk in 1 minute. Many years ago, when I was hosting Air Talk, I remember getting a call from a listener who was describing the economic feasibility of towing an iceberg to Southern California that could solve an earlier drought's water shortage problem. And, you know, those kinds of proposals have for years sounded absurd, how you would possibly do this. But a company in the United Arab Emirates is actually looking at doing this, taking a giant iceberg from the Antarctic to either South Africa, where, as you probably know, there's a catastrophic drought, or Australia. So is this really feasible? With us, freelance science writer who's written for NBC News about this, David Cox. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So tell us a little bit more about this company and the project that they're looking at doing.
Well, this is the thing, because as you said, the plan perhaps isn't quite as crazy as it might sound. So, I mean, it actually, happened, in the mid-1800s. So small icebergs were towed, from Antarctica all the way to Chile for use in breweries. And they're basically, kind of copying a strategy which is used in Canada at the moment. So every so often they have a big problem when you get icebergs which stray too close to offshore oil platforms. And they're essentially going to try and use the same technology. The only difference is they're going to be towing an iceberg, which is probably 10 times as big, and obviously towing it for thousands and thousands of miles further. So the plan is basically to scan the Antarctic Ocean using satellite images and possibly drones to try and identify a suitable iceberg, and then sort of sail a fleet of boats towards it. And initially, for this pilot study, which they want to do, try and tow a suitable one to either South Africa or to Australia. And then if that works, they reckon that should take about 3 months, and they should find out if it's successful or not by March next year. Then in April next year, they're going to try a much larger expedition and try and do the same thing and tow one all the way back to the United Arab Emirates.
Now, in towing an iceberg, what's involved? I mean, you put a chain around it? How do you tow an iceberg?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, in Canada, they're able to actually physically tow them because the icebergs are smaller. But in this case, I mean, we're talking about something which weighs 100 million tons. So it's not possible for any ship or with any conventional technology nowadays to actually physically tow it. What they're going to have to do is they're going to have to sort of very carefully map out a way to use the ocean currents. And in a way, these boats are basically going to be guiding it back. So they're going to connect a ship to the iceberg using this kind of giant steel cable, which they'll sort of lasso the iceberg with and connect it to the boat. And then they'll throw a mass of netting over the iceberg and possibly some insulating material as well. They're looking into a variety of different materials which can maybe stop a large proportion of the iceberg from melting on the way back, and then essentially try and guide it across the ocean. I mean, whether it will be actually feasible or not, who knows, but that's the plan.
How many square feet are they looking at in the size of an iceberg to do this?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, the typical one they're looking at would be about 1 kilometer across, which is pretty...
Wow.
I mean, it's going to probably be weighing in the region of 100 million tons. But this is the thing. The reason why they're aiming for an iceberg this big, you see, if they manage to sort of get that back, it will have enough drinking water for 1 million people for 5 years. Or in the case of Cape Town, they reckon it can maybe one iceberg could make up possibly a third of the city's entire water requirements for 1 year. So they're hoping if it's actually ultimately feasible, they could sort of launch an industrial scale operation, bringing back one iceberg every single year.
What, once you bring it into the warmer waters, how do you protect the iceberg, and how do you actually tap into it to get the water out of the iceberg distributed onto land?
Well, first of all, in order to try and, I mean, they estimate they're probably going to lose about 30% of the iceberg due to melting along the way. But to try and sort of keep as much of it as possible, they're going to map out specific ocean currents which they can use, like which are at cooler temperatures. So, you know, it will keep the iceberg as relatively cool as possible. And then once they get to about 30 miles offshore, then they will bring up lights of massive floating oil tankers, lights of towards the iceberg, and they use some special technology to try and lights of crush the iceberg over a period of months and months and months, and then slowly fill up the tankers and bring them back to shore.
Fascinating. David Cox, a freelance science writer who's written a piece for NBC News about this experimental project to take an iceberg from the Antarctic to Australia or South Africa and to see how feasible this is for providing drinking water after that multi-thousand-mile journey. Also with us is Chris Redinger, who is the head of the Antarctic team at the U.S. National Ice Center. They provide the worldwide navigational ice analysis for the U.S. Armed Forces, for our allies, and for various government agencies. Mr. Redinger, thank you for being with us.
It's great to be here.
What are your thoughts about a project that is this massive an undertaking? Is this potentially feasible?
It sounds like really interesting. I would be excited to see how it goes. There certainly are thousands and thousands of Antarctic icebergs from which they can choose from. So it could be a good experiment to help solve some water problems.
Well, and I'm just curious for your agency, it's sort of a bizarre sight for the traffic out, you know, in that area, seeing that, you know, a kilometer across iceberg being towed across the open ocean. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's funny. So we track icebergs around Antarctica, but primarily the ones that we track are on the scale of city sizes or U.S. state sizes like Delaware. So these are very small ones that we can barely see. But certainly the big ones would be impossible to do anything with. But as the big ones drift north, they can provide kind of an ejection of icebergs far enough north that maybe they can, and then as they break up, they can maybe grab one of those and not have to take it so far. So that could be a very good factor for them.
All right, Chris Redinger with us of the U.S. National Ice Center. If you have questions for our guests about this potential for taking an iceberg and providing drinking water, we're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. David, have there been any financial analysis to determine at what cost this would make sense for providing drinking water?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, there have been some estimates that it could be in the region of $100 million. So the company in the Middle East who are hoping to do this, I mean, they're hoping to get the cost down to about $30 million for, say, towing an iceberg from the Antarctica to Australia or Cape Town, and then maybe like $60 million like, so from towing it from Antarctica all the way to the UAE. I mean, and all this money is basically going to come from private investors. So there's a range of people who are basically going to profit from the sales of the water to governments or local water companies.
It's got to be tough, though, I would think, to get investment up front for this because it just sounds sort of far-fetched, I think, off the top and sounds like the potential return on this wouldn't be all that great. But do you know if there are investors who are coming into this?
Well, that indeed has been a big problem over the past 40 years. There's been so many people who've looked into it, ranging from French engineering companies to Saudi princes, and they've always failed to get the investment they'd need to actually launch a project. But amazingly, there are actually investors on board. I mean, it's not actually just this project in the UAE which is being financed, but there's also a company based in South Africa itself who are looking to sort of set up a partnership with the local government in Cape Town in order to bring an iceberg back specifically for that city. And they actually have, I believe, $120 million worth of investment from a Swiss company called Water Vision. So, I mean, if as long as they get the go-ahead from the local government in Cape Town, which they're waiting for later this month, they could be launching their own project later this year, and they already have the funding in place.
Chris, what about just the way that icebergs melt? Do you think that's going to be an impediment here, or is there something maybe they're not taking into account the challenges as icebergs break apart?
Well, they certainly, when they break apart, it's unpredictable what they can do, especially as they get smaller. They can, a piece will break and it'll roll over completely, and I'm not sure what that would do for any harnessing equipment. And the likelihood that it'll break up as it goes north, I'd say, increases as you get into that really warm water.
So that could be a safety issue if you've got people on boats that are involved in the towing of it, and it flips over. You could potentially capsize a bunch of boats.
Correct. Yeah. When they do flip, they can cause a mini tsunami that could swamp a smaller boat. So. The safety issues will definitely have to take into account.
All right. And are you skeptical of this over? I mean, you said it sounds interesting, but are you skeptical that this is actually going to work?
It might not be my place to say, but I don't know. I will say it will be interesting whether it's economically feasible as well as whether it can actually work. I know that some of the sea surface temperatures up, towards the Gulf up there can get towards 90 degrees Fahrenheit. And I don't know how long an iceberg will actually last up there.
Sayer in Boyle Heights wonders about the salinity of the iceberg melt. And is that something that potentially would have to be treated? Chris Redinger, do you know?
Well, the icebergs are from land ice, so they're from snow that's thousands of years old. So it is pure water. There's no salt in it. The trick will be to not try to harvest any seawater while they're harvesting the bergs.
Yeah, because potentially if there's any cross contamination, then you'd have to figure out how to desalinate it, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Carolyn Sherman Oaks wonders, in taking icebergs away, is there enough here that would have any effect on the surrounding ice in Antarctica? Chris Redinger, is there any way this would have an effect?
Oh, no. There would be, I think, zero effect. Because
the scale.
There's thousands of icebergs out there just drifting along and melting every single day. Antarctica produces so much ice. And this ice will just be out in the middle of the ocean melting anyway. So I don't think harvesting this will cause any kind of problems like that.
We have a listener who's posted on the page and said that the UAE is so serious about this that they are actually promoting the idea of glacial tourism in the Middle East. David Cox, have you heard anything about that?
I have heard rumors about that. Yes, that is a sort of a side project they are looking into to try and raise some additional revenue if they do manage to pull this off.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you both for being with us. That's David Cox, freelance science writer who's written on NBC News for this United Arab Emirates-based company that's planning to actually tow an iceberg to either South Africa or Australia from Antarctica. And my thanks to the head of the Antarctic team at the U.S. National Ice Center, Chris Redinger. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Leonard Maltin with us to talk about his new book right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Reminder, coming up tomorrow, it's Film Week. Our critics reviewing all the week's new movies. But we want to give you a little bit of an early taste of film with Leonard Maltin, great writer on film for many years on Entertainment Tonight, talking movies. But his career in film goes back to when he was a teenage boy. And growing up, writing for publications, and I think he was 15 when he was a publisher for the first time with hundreds of subscribers to his regular publication, and he still added his latest book, Hooked on Hollywood, Discoveries from a Lifetime of Film Fandom. Leonard, great to have you with us
again. Always good to see you, Larry.
So let's go. Was it 15 when you were a publisher?
Well, yeah. When I was 13, I found out about the existence of what we used to call fanzines. Now, this is, of course, long before the internet. Today, they would all be blogs and, you know, websites and whatever else. But in those days, people actually produced physical publications using ditto machines and mimeograph machines and whatever was available to us. Even xerography was just on the horizon. And I published my own eventually mimeographed publication with a friend when I was 13 and found out that there were others all over the country and beyond. And I wrote and sent unsolicited articles to one of them in Indiana, Pennsylvania, called the 8mm Collector, and one in Vancouver called Film Fan Monthly. And they both accepted my article, so I saw my name in print on a byline for the first time at age 13.
And the rest is history.
Well, I mean, there was no money involved. In that case, the rest is history. it was all a labor of love for everybody. Yeah. And 2 years later, the fellow who was producing Film Fan Monthly, who had been only 19 when I first contacted him, said, you know, I've got a full-time job now. I just don't have time to keep this up. Would you want to take over the magazine? Well, he was printed, professionally printed. Forget that, Mimeo. And he could use photographs. And he had 400 subscribers.
Paying subscribers?
Paying subscribers around the globe. Mostly North America, but also Australia and New Zealand, a little bit of Western Europe. So that was the most exciting thing that ever happened to me. At age 15, I became a punk version of Charles Foster Kane.
When you were at NYU as a student, were you already at that point starting to write longer form? And when did your first book come out?
Well, I signed a contract to do my first book, which was the first edition of my movie guide. It was then called TV Movies. Never a great title, but at the time it referred to people who stayed home and watched the morning movie on local TV and the mid-morning movie and the noontime movie.
Yeah, we had Ben Hunter here in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. All these hosts, that's
local
what they
hosts,
did.
Local hosts, exactly. Yeah. And it was round the clock. I mean, there was the Late Show and the Late Late Show, et cetera. So that was the book that I was hired to do at age 17. I was a high school English teacher at my school who I didn't have but who knew me, recommended that I meet this friend of hers, editor at Signet Books. And he said, do you know this book called Movies on TV by Stephen Scheuer? I said, I use it every day. I know it really well. He said, how'd you like to do it? I said, do what? He said, I'm trying to produce a rival book. You want to do it? And I swear that's what our first meeting, that's what happened. And he signed me, and we made the contract out to Film Fan Monthly rather than to me, in an attempt to fool his bosses that he wasn't hiring a minor. So my father didn't countersign the contract. It was probably invalid when I think about it now. But he said, so what are you going to do now? I said, well, it's spring. I'm going to NYU in the fall. He said, why? I just gave you a job. I said, well, I'm supposed to go to college? I mean, you know, that was the track that I was on, like straight arrow kid. And so I did go to NYU, and the book came out while I was at NYU.
Leonard Maltin.
It's a long answer to a short question.
No, but it's I just love it because it shows at even the youngest age, you can lock in on something that just is so much a part of you, and that sets the course for the rest of your life.
I know, and what's funny is I knew this somehow this was where I was heading, But everybody else found it unusual, which I never understood. It's like, well, why wouldn't you do this if you could?
Leonard Maltin's new book, Hooked on Hollywood. We're talking about when that addiction started, when he was just a lad, discoveries from a lifetime of film fandom. If you want to talk with Leonard about what's going on in the world of films, and yes, I will ask him about this announcement via Twitter from the Motion Picture Academy yesterday. I'm so interested to hear Leonard's thoughts. But if you want to ask him anything regarding film, 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. When I think of you doing that, you know, much higher level than I did, but I think of myself as the little kid with my microphone and my tape
of
recorder,
course.
You know, interviewing my friends.
It's,
and
it's
I did
easy
it.
For me to picture that, Larry.
Yeah,
it really is.
No, in fact, one of those kids just tweeted a picture of me when I must have been, I don't know, 11 years old. He's now the cartoonist, Kevin Fagan of Drabble, but he'd do his cartoons and I'd interview my friends.
How lucky we were to find our path so early.
Yeah, absolutely. And I knew a lot of kids like that who really found their place early on. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. So, Leonard, what do you think about this not fully formed concept, but that the Academy put out yesterday in a tweet that there's going to be some sort of, you know, popular film award?
Well, we've been edging toward that. For a while, when they expanded the Best Picture category from 5 to 10, that was a rather blatant attempt to open up the category a little wider in the hopes that it would embrace some more popular hit movies. It didn't happen that way. What happened was people just kept nominating more of the good movies that they liked, whether they were indie films or offbeat movies or, you know, or anything they happened to care for. And it usually didn't include the new Spider-Man film or, you know, some the next Star Wars sequel or something like that, what I tend to call popcorn movies. And that's not a pejorative term.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a definition. The Academy has never given them much respect except in the technical categories, sound, editing, makeup, visual effects, all of that. So that first attempt, which was, you know, kind of a nudge in this direction, didn't take the way they hoped it would. This, from I've read a number of stories since yesterday, may have been a directive from the ABC television network, which airs the Oscars, because the ratings are down. It's down to only 26 and a half million, Larry. Can you picture the shame?
Well, it's still the long-term trend, though, is pretty clear. I understand it's still a big audience.
It is going down. Yes, it is. And because young people are not interested, apparently, at all. People who are still, whether out of genuine interest or inertia, still interested, now have all these other award shows that steal some of the Academy's thunder. And the show goes on too long. Everyone agrees on that. So I don't think it's an awful or terrible idea. Some people are there's a lot of anger. You'll be shocked to find that there's some anger about this on the internet.
We heard from listeners when we opened up talking about I think the concern is that it's going to become a placeholder for films that are popular but should be in the Best Picture category. So we take, for example, Dunkirk or Get Out, both of which were big box office films, crowd pleasers, and were both nominated for Best Picture.
Right.
But what if those were shunted off to the popular category, and then you'd have to have, you know, Chris Nolan or you know, Jordan Peele get up and get an award for sort of consolation prize?
Well, you've made a decision there by saying that you're calling it shunted off and consolation prize. That's your legitimate interpretation. I don't know if that's going to be ultimately the interpretation that people take away. I mean, is it really a slap in the face to get an Academy Award for most popular picture of the year? I don't know that that's such an insult necessarily. Some people are taking it that way. I'm taking a wait-and-see attitude. And they did emphasize that a film could be nominated in both categories, which is interesting too.
All right. We're talking with Leonard Maltin, Hooked on Hollywood, Discoveries from a Lifetime of Film Fandom. We're going to talk with Leonard about what's included in the book, some of his favorite interviews, observations about Hollywood. These are some of the gems of Leonard Maltin over the years. We'll hear more about those as we continue, and we'll take your calls at 866-893-KPECC, or you can comment on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Back in just 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk, Larry Mantle with Leonard Maltin, expert on film for so many years, the Maltin Film Guide, a must-have. How many of us had it sitting there on the coffee table for quick references long before IMDb to get information about films? The great thing about Leonard's book was everything was there, all the credits, the reviews of the film. Prominent locations, everything. Remarkable resource. But he's written over the years many other things, too, and included some of his favorites in the new book, Hooked on Hollywood. Patrick in Santa Clarita, good to have you with us on Air Talk.
Hi, Leonard. Yeah, I'm a big fan. I used to use your books to help me archive my library of films. If I recorded one, I would make a note in your book whether I recorded it clean or with commercials or things like that. I was wondering about your opinion on Netflix. I know there's a controversy whether those should be allowed to be considered against the films that people have to go to a brick-and-mortar theater to see.
I know. It's an interesting question. Steven Spielberg said he considers them TV movies. And he's a veteran of TV movies himself. Yeah. He knows the territory. I'm not sure how I feel because some of them are made from the get-go as movies. They are intended to be seen by a movie audience. Whether that turns out to be the fact is a question. Last year, there was a very good film that I always get the title wrong. I Don't Want to Live in This World Anymore, I think is the title, with Melanie Lynskey.
We'll look it up and see.
Elijah Wood. And it won the grand jury prize at Sundance. And it had been pre-financed by Netflix. So it played at Sundance under that umbrella, wasn't looking for a distributor. And it's a very good film, but it sort of disappeared. See, this has always been the problem with different enterprises and different entrepreneurial ideas about bringing films into the home as opposed to opening them in theaters. Films that open in theaters spend multiple millions of dollars to make themselves known. And Netflix can't do that with every single film they present. They're so prolific now as impresarios, you might say, of documentaries and narrative films.
Well, and even so, it would sort of get lost in all the noise, even if they promoted all these films, because there are so many.
Exactly. And now they have so many competitors themselves.
The title is I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore.
That's
the film. So it's on Netflix, but presumably not that many people have seen it.
Not enough people have seen it, I suspect. And I don't think it had a lingering success in terms of reaching the public and reaching public awareness.
But there have been a lot of films historically that have been what they call four-walled, where it's put into theaters in L.A. and New York to qualify for the Oscars.
Yep, especially documentaries.
Yeah, a handful of people have seen it, and then, you know, gets that limited release and then sort of goes away. So does Netflix at least allow people who do want to see it, who don't live in a major city, a chance?
Well, in the good old, bad old days, films like that, the ones you're describing, would play in what we used to call college towns, in so-called art theaters, and at a handful of locations, just a handful. Sometimes they wouldn't even make the college towns. It would just be New York, Chicago, L.A., and maybe Toronto. And there was no access to see these films. The main thing Netflix does is provide access around the globe. And that's a good thing.
Thank you very much for the call. I wanted to ask you about all the interviews over the years, because you grew up as a kid who then was able to start meeting your screen idols and interview them and really ask them probing questions about the movies that they made. You've included a number in here, including Joan Blondell, one of my favorites. Burgess Meredith, another one of my favorites. You got so many good ones. Anita Loos. Just caught an Anita Loos screenplay film the other night on TV.
TCM.
Yeah, it's TCM, of course. Yeah, yeah. TCM. So you what's it like for you going back looking at some of these interviews for inclusion?
Well, a few of them I didn't include because they weren't very good. Largely my fault. Sometimes, Joan Blondell was a great example. A very pleasant woman. A guy set up a lunch for us because she was shooting an ABC TV show called Here Come the Brides.
Yeah.
And so I was, of course, interested in asking all about all those Warner Brothers films from the 30s, her co-stars, her directors like Busby Berkeley and all that. And she was not a nostalgic person. She lived in the present, which is an admirable trait. But she kind of reluctantly answered my questions and not, you know, with a anecdotal approach. So that was a tough interview in a way. I felt the flop sweat on the back of my neck getting, you know, very, very brief answers. But that was just the way she was. And I thought that was interesting to read.
Yeah.
So I kept that one in.
Yeah. And it's that challenge because you're sitting with someone who's living – Joan Blondell at that point is living history of
you
the
bet.
Golden age of cinema mm-hmm. and doesn't really want to talk about it because she's living in the 60s current age.
Exactly. Exactly. And again, I salute – someone like that who doesn't exist in another time period. And there are some people who did because they were no longer working. And all they had was their past, in a sense. And sometimes that's a little poignant, and sometimes it's revelatory because they have such good memories. Burgess Meredith is an example of somebody who straddled, you know, many decades of work. Younger people at the time I talked to him knew him as the Riddler,
the Penguin, actually.
The Penguin, right.
On Batman, yeah.
Yes, you see I'm getting all
that's,
my pop
that's
culture
all right. Frank
references
Gorshin
wrong.
Was the Riddler, but that's all right, yes.
And Burgess Meredith was a very intelligent man who'd been a writer, a director, a producer, as well as an actor. Loved the theater, as so many people do who start out in the theater, but also enjoyed a lot of his movie-making experiences. There's a lot of interest in Ernst Lubitsch today.
Yeah, oh,
and,
yeah.
And rightly so.
Shop Around the Corner, so many
yep.
great films.
UCLA is doing a series right now. My friend Joe McBride just wrote a new book on Lubitsch. Well, Burgess Meredith worked with Lubitsch and had things to say, and he was the opposite of Miss Blondell. You didn't have to drag anything out of him. He liked to talk, and he had interesting things to say, and there I am, you know, a teenager sitting there drinking all this in.
A man who worked under the so-called Lubitsch touch.
That's right.
So famously.
And found him a fascinating man. One of the things Lubitsch did was he used to act out every scene for the actors, which is death for many actors. They can't stand that. But Lubitsch, he said, was so exaggerated in his performances. It wasn't like getting a line reading. It's just getting the idea that he wanted to get across.
Leonard, thank you so much for coming in and talking about the new book. Appreciate it very much.
Very thank happy you. To be here always, Larry.
Thank you. Leonard Maltin's Hooked on Hollywood, Discoveries from a Lifetime of Film Fandom. And great chance to go back and look at some of the greats of Hollywood and some of Leonard's earliest reflections and how those evolved over the years. Stay tuned. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. Have a great day.